It's a real pleasure tonight at the launch of this exhibition to have Helen Painter with us. She is a minister and an author, a tutor at Bristol Baptist College. She heads up the Centre of Bible and Violence at the college. And Helen took part in a Bible Society podcasts earlier on in the year. If you were to search for those Bible Society podcasts, she too, you will find a similar theme discussed on those podcasts. She tells me that she's written a number of books over the summer. How many did you write over the summer? 3 books over the summer. There you go. I want to know how you do it. She does say they're very short. For me, that would be a page each. And her first of her books is at the back there. You may like to avail yourself of a copy of that at £10. Maybe you might tell us something a little bit about that book so that people know a bit more about it. And thank you so much for coming today as well, because I know it's your daughter's 17th birthday, so she's probably looking very gruff at home, or maybe not, I don't know. So we're very, very grateful for you joining us today. And you have some notes, I believe, in your chairs, which are relevant to Helen's talk. Thank you.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Sam, and what a wonderful occasion to be part of. I feel privileged to be here. Before I start, let me just, since I've been asked to mention my books. So I'm director, as Sam said, of the Centre for the Study of Bible and Violence. We do academic research in the area, but also we seek to do useful things for the churches in these tricky areas. Just thought I'd make you aware of that, because if you go on our website, if you Google us, you'll find our website, and there are things on the website that may be useful to you or to your church or home groups or whatever. The book at the back is a book addressed to people in the churches who are struggling with Old Testament violence in a general sense. So if that might be of interest, then it's there. If a tree falls in the forest and there is nobody to hear, does it make a sound? If a woman cries out in a man's bed and nobody is listening, did she make a sound? We could be speaking about so many women that we meet in the pages of our Bible. We could be speaking of Vashti, objectified by her husband and silenced through divorce because of her refusal to submit to his sexualization. We could be speaking of Tamar. Violated by her brother and then exiled, silenced by the passivity of her father David. We could be speaking of Bathsheba, summoned to the king's bed, impregnated, widowed, and married to the king without being consulted at any stage. But I want to talk tonight about Hagar, slave girl of Sarai, who was Abram's wife. This is back in the dark ages of Israel's story, back when the promise had only been spoken to one man, Abraham. I wonder how Hagar came into the household of Abram and Sarai. She was an Egyptian, so she was a long way from home. She was presumably young, because her fertility was never in doubt. Had she perhaps been purchased by Abram when he went down to Egypt that time? Had her family sold her to the patriarch? But while her backstory may be opaque to us, her predicament is quite clear. And as the curtain rises on Act 1, Hagar is trapped between two powerful people, between Sarai, her mistress, and Abram, her master. You see, Sarai is childless and old, and God has promised a son to her husband, Abram. And, well, that's what slave girls are for, isn't it? And Hagar is a chattel with no rights over her own body. As far as Abram and Sarai are concerned, she is an object to be used. a pawn to move around, a vessel to be filled. And so she is forced to serve her mistress by day and her master by night. At the instigation of her mistress, she is impregnated by her master. But once she's pregnant, Sarai feels threatened by her and begins to mistreat her. And Hagar's life becomes so intolerable that she flees into the wilderness. Just think about that. How desperate would you have to be to run away to the desert? Out of the frying pan, into the fire, one might say. Now, this is a drama in three acts. And at the close of Act 1, as Hagar flees to the desert, nobody has spoken to her. Nobody has looked at her. And nobody has listened to her. She is a non-person. Or there's been plenty of speech going on. Sarai and Abram have had quite extensive conversations about her, but nobody has spoken to her. Nobody has called her by name. She's just the girl slave. Nobody's listened to her either. Abram listens to the voice of his wife, but nobody has listened to Hagar. Her opinion has not been sought. Her complaint has not been heard. Did she cry out when her master raped her? Nobody was listening. Hagar moves through the household like a ghost. The sounds she makes drop to the ground like damp autumn leaves. And nobody has looked at her. Sarai calls Abram's attention to her own plight. You see how I am unable to bear children? But when Hagar is brought to her master's tent, nobody is watching. And when she creeps away in the morning, bloodied from the encounter, nobody sees. The household is blind to her suffering and deaf to her cries. And when Sarai complains about her to Abram, he tells her this: do to her as is right in your eyes. Not to turn her eyes to the girl in compassion, but to turn her gaze inward to her own desires. Unaddressed, unheard, unseen, she flees to the desert where she can crawl into a corner and die with the obscurity in which she has lived. She's a non-person, a ghost. Curtain up, Act 2. Hagar is in the desert, and she has found a spring of water. A funny thing, that. Because in Hebrew, the word for spring is ayin, and it's the same word as the word for eye. Because when an eye weeps, it is a spring of water. And so Hagar, the unseen, sits down at an eye. In fact, the writer is so insistent on the matter, he tells us twice. At an eye, she sat down, the eye on the shore road. It's almost as if he wants to draw our attention to it. One eye, two eyes. Maybe Hagar is not as invisible as she thinks. For it is there at the spring, the weeping eye in the desert, that the angel of the Lord finds her. Nobody else could have found her, because to find someone you have to be looking for them. And nobody's looking at Hagar. She's unseen, invisible, a non-person. A ghost. But not to God. When the angel of the Lord finds her, he addresses her. And he, the first one to do so, he calls her by name. And he asks her two questions. Hagar, where have you come from and where are you going? In other words, what is your history and what is your future? Remember how we don't know her backstory. Abram and Sarai don't care about her history. And it even appears to be a matter of indifference to our narrator. But it's not a matter of indifference to God. He invites her to tell him. And the angel of the Lord listens to her. He speaks to her. He listens to her reply. And then he says this. Now you have conceived and you will bear a son. You shall call him Ishmael, which means God hears, because the Lord has heard your affliction. It turns out she wasn't a ghost at all. Hagar's protests were heard by God. Her stifled cries in Abraham's tent were heard. Her weeping was heard. If a woman cries out in a man's bed, there is always someone who hears. And then Hagar does something very daring, something that nobody else in Scripture does. She names God. Her encounter with the one who addresses her by name, with the one who listens to her suffering, with the one who sees her in the desert. That encounter is so profound that she has to give a name to this deity. And she calls him El Roi, the God who sees me. And the spring also gets a name, Be'ir Lahai Roi, well of the living one who sees me. Because Hagar, little Egyptian girl slave, has encountered Abraham's God. Hagar's backstory was obscure, although not to God. But her future is not obscure. Because little Hagar, the little Egyptian girl slave, trafficked for sex and fertility, does not vanish once again into obscurity. God has seen her, and she will no longer be a ghost. For there in the desert, God makes her a promise. And then, in Act 3, when she finds herself again in the desert, this time with her son, God makes the promise again. Listen, I will greatly multiply your offspring so that they cannot be counted for multitude. And your son, I will make a great nation of him. I wonder if you've heard those promises before. They might be familiar, because God made the same promises to Abraham. I will make of you a great nation. I will make you the father of a multitude. And just as Abraham is a patriarch, so Hagar is a matriarch. She's come a long way since she was a little Egyptian ghost, because God saw her. God was listening to her, and God addressed her by name. It's estimated that there are tens of thousands of women in the United Kingdom right now who are living in slavery. You'll have passed them in the street. Did you see them? What are their names? What are their backstories? Most of them have been trafficked and feel unable to approach the authorities because of their illegal status. And they live in the grey twilight of the underworld. They have no access to healthcare, they receive no benefits, they are unable to report a crime against them, and they experience crime against them. Who is listening to them? Some of them are working in situations of domestic labour. They might turn up at your church one Sunday. Sometimes it's the only time that their owners allow them to go out. Will you see them? Or will they slip away like ghosts when the service is over? Many of them are working in the nighttime industry. They stand shivering in doorways, plying their custom, while their rich pimps watch from a heated car nearby. They sit on stained mattresses in locked rooms, servicing dozens of customers a week to make their owners rich. They suffer degradations that you could not imagine, producing pornographic films. And those who use their services, those who watch the films, do not see the people involved. They do to them as is right in their eyes. They do not look in compassion, but they turn their gaze inward to their own desires. But God sees them. God hears them. The psalmist says this: "The wicked pour out their arrogant words. All the evildoers boast. They crush your people, O Lord. They kill the widow and the stranger. They murder the orphan, and they say, 'The Lord does not see.' Understand this, O dullest of the people, fools. When will you be wise? He who planted the ear, does he not hear? He who formed the eye, does he not see?" And this God who sees, this God who hears, this God who attends to the invisible, this God took on flesh and became a man. And his ministry was distinguished by his attention to those that others did not see, those that others did not listen to. The woman who crept to the well at midday when everyone else was resting in the shade. The woman who was taken in adultery, as though that is a solo activity. The bleeding woman, hidden in plain sight. Because God sees the invisible people. God hears the cries of the voiceless. In her magnificent art, Jen has explored the histories of these invisible, inaudible women. And she invites us to look at them with compassion. She invites us to hear their voices, expressions of protest, cries of pain, words of rebuke, entreaty, remonstrance, revelation. These women speak wisdom to us. Their voices have outlasted those of their abusers. They assert their existence, their value, and their dignity. And they are therefore the voice of God to us.
Helen, a very, very big thank you to you for coming this evening, for being so profound in what you had to say to us, stuff for us to continue to reflect on. God speaking to us in every face of these women around the walls. There's refreshments at the back. Please feel free to talk to Jen and to Helen some more. Helen's book is for sale at the back there. And a thank you to Jen, if you would like to come and take that. Just a small thank you, and to Helen for coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and please feel free to mill around.